The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, I'm Doris Hyde for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Vision News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Rolling Stone on January 11th, the CDC disses disabled. From the Discoverer, the five most accessible world destinations. From Forbes, what does living with COVID mean for the disabled? From Disability Rights NC, changes to segregated employment in North Carolina. From the USA Today, child tax credit letter from the IRS is important to keep. National Disability Rights Network has a report on schools and the disabled. So let's get started. From RollingStone.com on January 11th by Marissa Cabas, K-A-B-A-S. Disabled Americans feel abandoned by the CDC. Now CDC is desperate to make amends. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky made a comment last week that enraged the disability community, but advocates say the agency has a habit of dismissing the most vulnerable. On Friday, the CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky appeared on Good Morning America and made a statement that pissed off large swaths of the country. The overwhelming number of COVID deaths, over 75%, occurred in people who had at least four comorbidities. So really, these are people who were unwell to begin with, Walensky said. It's really encouraging news in the context of Omicron. Immediately, people with disabilities and comorbidities were furious. By Monday, the CDC knew they had a problem. According to an email shared exclusively with Rolling Stone, the CDC has tasked Karen Remley, R-E-M-L-E-Y, Director for the National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities, NCBDDD, at the CDC, with repairing the damage. The email, which was sent to organizations in the disability community, asks for an opportunity to meet and discuss how the organization might help the communities that feel dismissed by them. I'm aware of the concerns that have been circulating around comments made related to Omicron death statistics and comorbidities, Remley writes. I would like to connect on a telephone call to discuss this in more detail and to learn more about how CDC, NCBDDD, and I can be of support to you and the audiences we collectively care deeply about. Some have dismissed the controversy as overblown, a willful misrepresentation of what she meant. She was referring to a study of vaccinated people and the small number of deaths among them, which was edited out of the version aired by GMA. She is deeply concerned and cares about the health and well-being of people with disabilities and those with medical conditions who have been impacted by COVID-19, a representative told Rolling Stone. But for disabled and chronically ill people, they finally heard the quiet part out loud. Since the beginning of the pandemic, they've already been told they are at the highest risk of dying from COVID, and increasingly they're hearing that it's not worth the effort to protect them. Maria Towne, President and CEO of the American Association of People with Disabilities, remains disheartened by Walensky's comments. It highlights the fact that the director and the CDC view people with disabilities as acceptable losses during the COVID-19 pandemic, Towne tells Rolling Stone. Her comments, even with the additional context, reveal the systemic and institutional biases against disabled people that determine our lives are inherently worthless. When the CDC released its latest COVID isolation guidelines late last month, it marked another disturbing turning point for disabled Americans. The agency shortened the timeline and added a bullet point stating people who were recently infected should avoid people who are immunocompromised or at high risk for severe disease and nursing homes and other high-risk settings until at least after 10 days. Matthew Cortland, a senior fellow at Data for Progress, focusing on disability policy and an attorney, wonders how this would work in the real world. How on earth is anyone supposed to know that I'm immunocompromised? Cortland, whose disability isn't visible, tells Rolling Stone, is the CDC going to send me some sort of wearable sandwich board warning people I'm immunocompromised? Or does CDC expect me to make my own? There's question belies a fundamental misunderstanding of what it means to be disabled, that it can be seen with the naked eye, or that disabled people can make themselves scarce for the convenience of others. Are we supposed to just stay in our homes indefinitely so that other people who are COVID positive and who were told by the CDC they can go back into the world while still infectious can just get on with their lives, Cortland asks. The truth is, advocates say, that dialogue between the disability community and the CDC regarding COVID safety should have happened long ago, with the CDC director herself, before the Omicron variant reached the states. According to a 2019 report from the Center for American Progress, disabled adults experience poverty at nearly twice the rate of non-disabled adults, yet disabled people who rely on government assistance to survive have yet to be provided with a single free N95 mask or a single home testing kit, an idea that was openly mocked by White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, P-S-A-K-I. Millions of Americans without the money, resources, and ability to access tools to mitigate the risk of contracting COVID have been abandoned by the CDC, and with the push to get back to work, there are no signs of that changing. My anger at the administration as a high-risk person is founded on a lifetime of institutions and people who do not see my inherent worth, whether I can produce or not, Alice Wong, a disabled activist with a neuromuscular disability who uses a ventilator, tells Rolling Stone. Who does the CDC serve? Not marginalized communities who predicted the disastrous ways this pandemic would unfold without decisive leadership. From thediscoverer.com, 5 most accessible destinations around the world. Travel should be for everyone, regardless of our limitations. Luckily, there are plenty of places that are equally accessible for the fully able as for those with disabilities. What's more, plenty of destinations are making changes to their infrastructure to open their doors to more people. With this in mind, we've put together a list of the most accessible destinations and all the amazing things you can do while you're there. Melbourne, Australia. Compact cities are the perfect choice for those with reduced mobility, making Melbourne one of the most accessible cities in the world. The public transport system is easy to navigate, meaning you can get to all of the fantastic wheelchair-friendly restaurants. Make sure to take a trip to the Great Ocean Road, Victoria's Parks, and see it all from up high at the Eureka Skydeck. If you've always dreamed of being a surf dude, then Melbourne will not disappoint. The Disabled Surfers Association of Australia will help you realize your dreams and ride the waves like a pro. Barcelona, Spain. The National Tourism Authority is hot on accessible travel in Barcelona, making it an excellent location for anyone with mobility difficulties. Almost all of the metro stations and buses are wheelchair-friendly, so you can make sure you see all of the sights. When you're moving at your own pace, you'll be pleased to know there are accessible walkways throughout the city, so you can avoid cobblestones. Not only are a lot of the museums and attractions accessible, but many allow wheelchair users to jump to the front of the queue and even enter for free. When you need to cool down, the beach awaits with many access points and people on hand to help you if you need it. Playa del Carmen, Mexico. There should be nothing stopping you visiting one of the best beaches in Mexico. Many of Playa del Carmen's hotels are accessible to wheelchair users, and with everything within walking distance, there is no need for public transport. What's more, you don't need to grind to a halt when you hit the sand either. Beach wheelchairs can be rented out. With uniquely designed wheels, they can move across the sand and even into the water. If you can't swim, there's adaptive equipment to allow you to snorkel amongst the coral reef. Away from the beach, you can immerse yourself in Mayan history at the wheelchair-accessible archaeological sites of Chichen Itza and Tulum, T-U-L-U-M. Manchester, United Kingdom. While London is often the first city that comes to mind in the UK, Manchester has loads to offer and is ideal for those looking for accessibility. Much of the city was rebuilt in the late 1990s after the Industrial Revolution, resulting in wide, smooth pavements and stepless shop and restaurant entrances. With accessible public transport at your fingertips, you'll be able to visit all the sites and even pay a visit to Old Trafford. If you've had enough of city life, the Peak District National Park, at less than an hour away, has well-developed facilities and even adapted cycle equipment for hire. Singapore. Singapore is renowned for its barrier-free accessibility measures, which have been in place for over 20 years. Visiting a city that has been aware of accessibility needs for such a long time makes a huge difference. Infrastructure has been built with stepless access in mind. The mass rapid transit system and buses have been designed for the visually and motor impaired. As getting around the city is so easy, there's very little you can't do. Take a trip to Chinatown, visit the extraordinary city zoo, and get your fill of incredible street food at one of the many food hawker centers. Sicily, Italy. Sicily may not be the most obvious destination for accessible travel, but it's certainly earned its place. It's worth mentioning for wheelchair users that there are cobbled streets and narrow pavements to contend with. However, a number of the UNESCO World Heritage Sites on offer, including Mount Etna, are accessible. On top of this, for the visually impaired, the island is home to a tactile museum and Europe's only sensorial botanic garden. When you're not sat enjoying the incredible cuisine, scuba diving, and four-wheel drive off-road driving, and traditional Sicilian fishing trips await. Leanne Frith, F-R-I-T-H, is a freelance writer for The Discoverer with a penchant for learning foreign languages, and what better way to practice than in situ. She loves to use her linguistic skills to get in the know with the locals. Seeking out intriguing music, new forms of dance, and fabulous food, she revels in being a discoverer. From Forbes.com, What Does Living with COVID-19 Mean for Disabled and Chronically Ill People? By Andrew Pulrang, P-U-L-R-A-N-G. Published December 28th. Wiping out COVID-19 might once have been possible, but that time really has passed. If so, that has implications for everyone. But it's a doubly complex and troubling prospect for people at highest risk. There seems to be a growing consensus that COVID can't be beaten, at least not in the way many of us hoped for back in early 2020. And it's not just politicians pandering to COVID fatigue who are saying so. Many of our most trusted scientists are suggesting that COVID in some form is here to stay. Depending on who you ask, that's either a drab sort of relief, a shameful and deadly surrender, or the signals for some major social and lifestyle changes. We as a society may have to, quote, live with COVID now, like we essentially live with influenza, heart disease, and car accidents. But what does that mean for those of us who will still face not just the equivalent of an unwelcome cold from COVID, but the real possibility of serious illness, long-term suffering, or death? What about those of us who are old, disabled, or chronically ill, who are still far more vulnerable to COVID's deadly effects despite access to effective vaccines and treatments? The current Delta and Omicron waves continue to present new short-term fears, policy dilemmas, and human implications, especially for people with disabilities and chronic illnesses. But the longer-term questions and possibilities around COVID are probably the same as they were a month or two ago. In fact, disability and chronic illness advocates have been wrestling with these same existential threats and the appalling results of policy and social justice failures associated with them since the pandemic began. From a disability perspective, there seem to be essentially two views of a future with COVID, each with its own logic, plausibility, and mixture of terror, anger, and wishful thinking. The pessimist view. We are already seeing a higher tolerance throughout society for catastrophically deadly pandemics, even as vulnerable people keep sickening and dying. We may find ourselves adjusting to a more or less permanently higher death rate from illness, as opposed to accident or age, and acceptance of these deaths being imposed mostly on very specific populations. As a result, the type of eugenics philosophy could become even more widely accepted, in which a much higher rate of suffering and loss of old, disabled, and chronically ill people is viewed as sad, perhaps, but also natural. There are already people who not only believe this is unavoidable, but in a sense, right. Survival of the fittest may soon once again become not just a glib cliché, but a popular and validated social philosophy. Meanwhile, responsibility for protecting our lives and health care may be placed entirely on us, on all individuals, but especially on those of us most vulnerable, the elderly, chronically ill, and people with disabilities. With most of the public feeling comparatively safe, the sick of broad-based restrictions and government actions, COVID may become in some sense a disability community illness, our problem to deal with. Worse yet, in the long term, disabled and chronically ill people's basic mobility could become permanently restricted, and our rights infringed in ways we haven't seen for decades. We stand to lose many of the physical and social freedoms won by the modern disability rights movement. We could find ourselves driven back literally behind closed doors, out of public view and engagement. This time, our isolation wouldn't be from any sort of direct legal or social discrimination, but rather a byproduct of society's fundamental unwillingness to take even modest, long-term steps to help protect us. Others' inaction could leave us no choice but to restrict ourselves. Then there is the temptation to deny high-risk elderly, disabled, and chronically ill people medical treatment. When resources are pressed, could become revived and widely institutionalized, in effect sentencing some of us to a legal death due to disability. These are worst-case scenarios for what living with COVID might look like for the disability community. There's more than a little evidence that the pessimist view may also be the realist view. But it doesn't have to be like this. There are other possibilities. The hopeful view. We might see easier access and further development of even more effective vaccines that substantially reduce both the likelihood of catching COVID and its severity. Maybe our original optimistic timeline was off. Vaccination could still help crush COVID or curtail it much more than it has done so far. And if more like 90% of people do ultimately embrace vaccination, it could finally help protect those of us who are more vulnerable to COVID or less able to protect ourselves from it. We could see a growing availability of treatments effective enough to make COVID a lot less deadly for everyone, including elderly, disabled, and chronically ill people. Being high risk or not isn't a binary state. We can be at somewhat higher risk of slightly greater sickness without COVID being an automatic death sentence, even for those of us at highest risk. It's possible we could get there to a situation where COVID really is no worse than a cold or a mild flu for everyone. Whatever happens with vaccines and treatments, maybe the rest of society won't completely forget about COVID. Living with COVID doesn't have to mean ignoring it. It's possible that we all could incorporate some new habits, more or less permanently, into our lives, like wearing masks in certain situations and during certain times, making jobs and pay more secure for all workers when they need to take time off for illness, and making work-from-home opportunities better and more permanent. Higher-risk people might also develop a stronger and more permanent voice in helping shape popular attitudes toward communicable diseases and public health. Our strong but often fragmentary advocacy could start to unify, solidify, and pay off. We might finally persuade our fellow citizens to embrace a reasonable degree of caring and caution, specifically geared to protecting medically vulnerable people. And our governments could change their communication and public health policies to recognize our unique needs and make them a full part of society's agreed-upon social responsibility, not an afterthought or niche exception. In this kind of better case scenario, disability rights could actually grow stronger. We could decisively win the right to treatment, regardless of disability, doing away completely with medical rationing or pressure on people with certain disabilities to accept do-not-resuscitate orders. We could forge a new commitment to accessible public health information for all, including those with intellectual and communication disabilities. We could invest more in home care, so fewer elderly and disabled people have to be exposed to communicable diseases in crowded facilities. We could, finally, unequivocally, establish higher vaccinations and treatment priority for people with disabilities and chronic conditions. Of course, it may not be too late to even now kill off COVID rather than just surrendering to it. The case for not giving up is strong, and the implications for accepting COVID in any meaningful way are hard to defend, especially from a disability and chronic illness perspective. 815,000 Americans have died of COVID-19 so far, that was before the holidays, 5.4 million worldwide. These numbers are unacceptable by any measure. We are living through a new, massive, and substantially preventable human tragedy. And while COVID isn't the largest annual cause of death in the world, we must remember that it is another major cause of death that simply wasn't there before 2020. COVID doesn't replace the annual statistics that skeptics like comparing them to. Like the flu, heart disease, or car accidents, COVID adds to them. But at this point, anger and activism will only get us so far. Unlike other social problems, pandemics do have a natural medical component that may really be beyond complete human control. There may really be no way to entirely beat COVID. It may have always been beyond our capability, even with the best, most enlightened, and objective policy approaches we can imagine. But if we as a society are resigned to living with COVID, then elderly, disabled, and chronically ill people are still going to need better from society than we've had so far. If we can't count on collective action to crush COVID, as we once hoped, we can at least insist on not being left to bear its dangers alone. From DisabilityRightsNC.org, Changes to Segregated Employment in NC, posted January 20th. In North Carolina, over 1,000 people with disabilities work in isolated, segregated settings, also called Sheltered Workshops or Adult Developmental Vocational Program, ADVP, settings. In these settings, workers with disabilities are typically separated from non-disabled workers. Most pay workers fall far below the minimum wage, sub-minimum wages. Many disabled people work 5 days a week and still earn less than $100 a month. The workshops are supposed to train people with disabilities to work in the community for market or competitive wages. Studies show this kind of job training is ineffective in finding disabled people jobs in their community or teaching them useful job skills to compete in the marketplace. A federal law called the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, protects the right of people with disabilities to work in the community in jobs for honest wages, just like non-disabled people. Because of this law, DRNC, the Center for Public Representation, CPR, and NC Department of Health and Human Services, DHHS, recently agreed that DHHS will stop paying for services in segregated workshops. Instead, DHHS will help workers with disabilities find better-paying jobs in their communities. Summary of the agreement. Here is a list of changes DHHS agreed to help you find a job in the community. DHHS will eventually stop paying for the services you are receiving in the workshop. DHHS will stop paying for Adult Developmental Vocational Program, ADVP, and ADVP-like services. Number 2, DHHS will only spend its money on services that help you get and keep a job in the community. Your job will pay at least minimum wage. Here are some of the services that DHHS will offer to help you find a job in the community. Supported employment. Someone will help you find work and can go with you to work as long as you need to learn the job and do it well. They can also help your boss learn what you need from them to do your job well. Customized employment. If you cannot do all parts of the job, someone can help you find a boss who will let you do only the parts of the job you are good at. College education. Available when you need more schooling to get the job you want. Discovery. Someone will help you learn about your interests and figure out what kind of job you may be interested in doing. Transportation. Someone will help you figure out how you will get back and forth to work. Assistive technology. If you need technology to help you do your job, it can be provided for you. Benefits counseling. Someone who can help you understand how the money you make at your job may affect your Social Security check and health care. Number 3, DHHS will contact you if you worked in a workshop in the last 2 years to tell you about these new services and give you an opportunity to try them out. These are big changes, and it will take time to make them. You will not lose the services you have right now. You can continue working in a workshop until July 1st, 2026. But you can also start looking for a job in the community tomorrow. It is up to you. The goal of the agreement is for everyone with disabilities who wants to work to have competitive, integrated employment. Important dates to remember. July 1st, 2022. No new people can get ADVP or ADVP-like services in the workshops. Their services will only be available to people already getting them. July 1st, 2023. Everyone working in workshops or who got ADVP or ADVP-like services in a workshop after January 1, 2020 will have an employment assessment. People who want to work in the community will have a career development plan. July 1, 2026, no one can get ADVP or ADVP-like services in segregated settings anymore. DHHS will help the workshops get ready for these changes. The workshops that want to help people find jobs in the community will get technical assistance and training on how to do it. Working in the community. You might not know what you are good at or be worried that you will not be able to do a job in the community. These new services will make sure you get the help you need to get a job and keep it. You will work with people who do not have disabilities at your job, and you will be paid at least the minimum wage, just like everyone else. This kind of work is called competitive integrated employment. FAQs about DHHS's plan. Why is DHHS making changes to employment services? People in segregated settings usually get paid some minimum wage. Many people work 5 days a week and still earn less than $100 a month. They are also kept apart from people without disabilities. There are laws protecting the right of people with disabilities to work in the community in the same kinds of jobs as non-disabled people. DHHS has agreed to help people in segregated settings find and keep better jobs in the community. What changes is DHHS making to services in segregated work settings? DHHS is planning to help everyone working in segregated settings like ADVP get jobs in the community. If you receive services in ADVP settings, you will soon get new services to help you figure out your job skills, discover different jobs you are good at and would like, develop a plan that is unique to you, find and keep a job in the community. When will these changes happen? Your services are not going to change right away. You can continue receiving services in ADVP settings until 2026, but you will start giving new services soon to help you learn about working in the community. When you decide what kind of work you want to do, someone will help you find a job. What new services will I get? Most people will receive supported or customized employment services, but you can also get supported internship services, help with self-employment, or more schooling. Your services will be designed for you based on the job you want and what you will need to be able to do that job. How long will I receive the new services? Someone will help you plan for how long you need new services. They will look at how much help you need to get and keep the new job you want. If you need long-term help, you can get it through your LME/MCO. What if I want to keep my ADVP services? You can keep your ADVP services until 2026. After 2026, you will have to choose new services if you decide not to work in the community. What if I don't want to work in the community? No one will make you get a job in the community, but you will be given information about what it is like to work in the community. You will be asked why you do not want a job in the community. If you are scared or nervous about working in the community, you can meet with other people with disabilities who left their job in a workshop and went to work in the community. They can answer your questions about working in the community. If you are still sure you do not want to work in the community, someone will tell you about other services that you can sign up for. What will happen to the people who provided my current services? People who are providing services in segregated settings can get training and to help people find jobs in the community. Will I get more information about the changes that are coming? Yes, you will get a letter from DHHS explaining the changes to your employment services. DHHS will have meetings to explain the new services to you and to the people providing your services. You will be able to ask questions at the meeting. DRNC and DHHS will keep updating our websites with more information about these changes. I have more questions. Who can answer them? You may call DRNC at 919-856-2195. Select option 3 to talk to an intake advocate. You can also ask for legal help online, or you can visit DRNC's employment page for up-to-date information about the changes to employment services. Well, I ran out of time, so the other two articles will have to wait. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Doris Hyde, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. This content is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Vision News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.